American Social History Podcasts are a production of the American Social History Project, Center for Media and Learning at the City University of New York. This presentation took place at the CUNY Graduate Center as part of our Bridging Historias through Latino History and Culture program, a National Endowment for the Humanities Bridging Cultures at Community Colleges project.
I think cartoons are often a way to get at some really uncomfortable truths that are hard for students to think about. And I always start with this image of the Alamo. Is anybody from Texas? Sorry. people in Texas are sort of really invested in the idea of the Alamo and what happened at the Alamo. And this image here is actually pretty historically accurate. The Mexican forces surround the Alamo. They surrendered and turned over to the Mexican forces. But that's not the way that American history has remembered it, and particularly Hollywood. And if you ask most Texans or you ask most people what they remember about the Alamo, this is the story that they will tell. How the brave people inside the Alamo, including Davy Crockett, as evidenced by John Wayne here, went down fighting. When his gun breaks off and it doesn't work anymore, he picks it up and he starts beating the Mexicans away from him. So I like to use some of these images to think about how we tell stories, how we think about history, and how important national memory is to Americans, and in particular case, Texas identity. And it's a great way for students to begin to start thinking about how to unpack history and why history really matters. So the question we come up with today, so this is 1836. By 1848, we're really beginning to start to think about what this U.S.-Mexican border means. And this is very much a line that is imposed onto a landscape that in some ways is very much unified, that is a desert landscape. Most of the border up until El Paso is along the Rio Grande River. And what I like students to think about is that rivers are actually something that bring communities together, right? Both sides of the river have some kind of economic interest with each other. They have a geography that is very similar, regardless of which side of the river that you are on. And yet, in most cases, we use rivers as political boundaries. We use rivers as ways of dividing up groups of people. For most of the 19th century, and I would argue for a big chunk of the 20th century, people who lived alongside the border, whether they lived north of the border in the United States or south in Mexico, had much more in common with each other culturally, socially, the kind of foods they ate, the language they were speaking, their familial relationships, than they ever had with the centers of their countries. So people along the border had more in common with the people who lived in Texas than they did with people in Mexico City. People who lived in New Mexico, Arizona, the southern part of California, had much more in common with the people across the border than they did with people in Washington, D.C., who, not, as we know, in many cases were very much in opposition. So I think we want students to think about borders as places that can actually bring people together and to think of them as cohesive groups and not always as a place that divides nations. I think if you ask your students what a border looks like, they'll talk about the fence, they'll talk about drones, they'll talk about border control, they'll talk about all these things that separate it. And I think putting the border into historical context and really getting students to think about how this at one point was a unified place, and this border has been very much marked, designated, made military in all kinds of really important ways, and talking about that historical process can lead to really profitable discussion. So let's sort of move on here. Let's talk a little bit about what actually creates the border, and just sort of skip ahead to the end of the U.S.-Mexican War. As you know, the war takes place between 1846 and 1848. It actually starts as a border skirmish and an issue over Texas. Texas had been an independent country from the mid-1830s until 1845, when the U.S. decided to annex, President Polk did. Mexico saw this as an act of aggression because they had never recognized Texas independence after the Alamo and the aftermath of that. And so this created a border tension between the two countries. This is the moment of manifest destiny where the United States is beginning to really think of itself as a continental nation. And in the space of the 2 years, they pick up all this territory from Mexico, which we'll focus on, and also the territory up in the Northwest, what is today Oregon and Washington. So in the space of about 5 years, the territorial sort of ideas an aggrandizement of the country really coalesce around these two things. What's important about the U.S.-Mexican War is that this is really the first time that the U.S. has fought a war that can really be attributed to total aggression. They crossed the border into Mexico. Much of the war is fought in the northern provinces, out on the western coast in Veracruz, and eventually U.S. troops move into Mexico City and occupy Mexico City. And this is the first time that the U.S. flag at some point is actually flown over a foreign U.S. capital. And people were very uncomfortable about this, particularly people like John Quincy Adams, Abraham Lincoln, who was not an early proponent of the war. And people really wondered, what did this mean for a democracy and a republic to be flying a flag of imperialism and a flag of aggression over a foreign country? Was this really what a young nation should be in the business of doing? When the U.S. took over, there was a fairly significant political force in the United States that wanted to have the All Mexico movement. And the idea was that all the territory of Mexico would actually be incorporated into the United States. And so you can imagine today in the United States that goes from, you know, the northern border with Canada all the way down to the tip of Mexico. You know, and people argued, particularly Southern Democrats who were interested in the spread of slavery into this territory, it seemed like a good place for that, that this could be a very significant move for the United States and something that could bring them lots of wealth. In the end, the plan was thwarted, and I argue that it's for three very different groups who somehow actually came together despite their different political ideologies. First of all, northern liberals, as I said, people like Adams and Lincoln, worried about the idea of conquest and the idea of democracies and republics engaging in this kind of behavior with their neighbors, who were also, Mexico was a republic at the time. The question of slavery clearly comes to the forefront. Northerns are very leery of bringing in this much territory, which has the potential to become slave states in the territorial process. And then finally, in the end, I would really argue that racism and anti-Catholic behavior on the part of people in the United States is one of the major reasons that they are not incorporated into the United States. And the question really becomes, when you incorporate this kind of land, this much land, what are you going to do with the 8 million people who live there? This is a population of Mexicans, Indians, mixed peoples, Catholics, and I think we can't sort of underestimate the anti-Catholic sentiment that's going on here. And so that becomes a very difficult political and ideological question for the United States to deal with. And in the end, it's thwarted, and we only take the northern portion of Mexico along the border of the Rio Grande. Yeah?
How viable was it to think that the U.S. could actually conquer all of Mexico, that there would be a reaction?
I think there definitely would have been a reaction. I think, you know, one of the other great myths is that this was a bloodless conquest of the territories that actually, you know, New Mexico, Texas. There was lots of pushback, even from places like California and New Mexico that were very much sort of alienated from the center of Mexico. So certainly, if you think about taking over central Mexico, Mexico City, which has a very anti-Yankee, anti-American sentiment, it would not have been bloodless by any stretch of the imagination. But what's interesting to me is that often doesn't play into it. They think, oh, we won. Our flag sitting in Mexico City, it's all over. It's our decision to make. And I think it doesn't sort of play with the political realities that are down there. One of the things that I really like to do with my students is to do an analysis of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, which is actually still a very important treaty that is the basis for much of our relationship with Mexico today. It actually gets mentioned in the NAFTA trade agreement when it's talked about. And I just want to go over a couple things and then talk about two provisions in it. It said annexed half of Mexico, created the Rio Grande as the international border, actually paid $15 million to Mexico for the territory that it took. The ironic thing is that that is precisely the amount of money that the U.S. had offered Mexico before the war had even started. And they had said, we'll give you $15 million if you give us Texas, New Mexico, California. And I think that goes to your point. Mexico was not interested in just sort of ceding that territory. So in the end, they got a war and their $15 million. The great irony of all of this is that the treaty is signed by Mexico on July 4th of 1848, just barely the day after gold is discovered at Sutter's Fort in California. So the moment that this land is turned over to the United States, all of a sudden California becomes one of the richest pieces of property and territory in North America, and Mexico's given that up to the United States. And then finally, the last little piece of land, the Gadsden Purchase, is picked up in 1854. I like to look at two particular articles of the treaty, and then I have the students focus on two particular articles. The first is Article 9, and this is the article that establishes citizenship for Mexicans who are being incorporated into the United States. So these were people who were living in Texas, California, and New Mexico. And I just want to read you two sections here. When the treaty was first put into its original, the original writing of it, that was carried out between the two diplomatic corps of the United States and Mexico, this is the wording that it talked when it talked about how citizens would be incorporated. It said, Mexican citizens who in the territories aforesaid shall not preserve the character of citizens of Mexican, of the Mexican Republic, so they're giving up their Mexican citizenship, shall be incorporated into the Union of the United States and admitted as soon as possible, according to the principles of the federal constitution, to the enjoyment of all the rights of citizens of the United States. And this was very much meant to conform with the Northwest Ordinance that had passed in the 1780s about how territories would be incorporated and how people would be brought in as citizens. And so it seems all very straightforward and clear and fair. This is the way they had treated citizens who had been brought in as a result of the Louisiana Purchase and the Floridas as well. When this document actually got to the U.S. Senate, it was rewritten and modified. And by the time it was ratified, this is how the language went. So Mexicans who are not going to be Mexican citizens will conformably with what is stipulated by in the preceding article, and here's the money quote, shall be incorporated into the Union of the United States and be admitted at the proper time, and then quotes, to be judged by the Congress of the United States to the enjoyment of all rights of citizens of the United States. So now citizenship is no longer a right that comes with this international treaty. It's now up to Congress to decide when citizenship will be granted to these people. States like New Mexico and Arizona had the longest territorial period of any states brought into the Union, with the exception of Puerto Rico, which still has not been brought in to the Union. Texas was immediately admitted because it had a whole sort of different historical trajectory. California was obviously very early admitted in 1850, but that was because of the massive amount of migration that had happened as a result of the gold rush. So here we see where citizenship is now becoming a contested political idea at this moment. The last one I just want to look at real quickly is Article 10, and this is about issues of property. As you know from, you guys read my little piece, there was always this conflict between the two systems of property, between the United States and Mexico. And the Mexican government wanted to preserve these property rights very clearly for their citizens who are being incorporated. And Article 10, if when you look at the document, you'll see there are three paragraphs that go into deep, long detail about how this will happen. Basically, what they're saying is any land right, any land grant that existed under Mexican law shall be considered valid under U.S. law. Again, that seems very fair and very clear. When this article and this section got to the U.S. Senate, it was completely stricken out. So in the final version of the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, there is no Article 10. There's absolutely nothing that preserves the property rights of former Mexican citizens in the United States. And we could talk about how sort of ideas of property feed into these ideas of citizenship. And so what you see is a whole group of people who are entering the United States with a citizenship that's already sort of compromised and having to face a system of legal regime where they have to prove property rights that had existed in a prior regime. And so you begin to see sort of the off-kilter balance of this. Okay, I want to skip ahead just a little bit to the late 19th century. So after the treaty, we have the Civil War. We sort of move ahead to the industrialization of the Western frontier, the Western countryside. And Mexican labor becomes a really important piece of this. And this image is a little out of our time, but I think you get a sense of it. Mexicans were very much lured into the United States because of the massive opportunities for them in terms of the industrialization of the countryside. So agricultural production is going up, industrialization inside of Western cities is all drawing people across the border. And one thing I'd like my students to really understand is that prior to 1910, the border was pretty much free and open. There might have been crossings here and there. People were very rarely checked. People crossed for the day, went back and forth. People had family who lived on the other side. They'd go see their grandmother on the other side. They'd go visit somebody. They'd come back at the end of the day. And people, for the most part, like this, particularly American industrialists. Companies who were beginning to come in and grow large agricultural production, mining companies, they love this sort of free flow of immigration and people into this kind of work. For the most part, I think we can think of this in many cases a lot of male work, male transients that's coming in. And again, I try to really emphasize to my students that the issue of citizenship is not at the forefront of how people are thinking about their identity. I think they're thinking about themselves as workers. They're thinking of themselves as family members who are taking money back to their families. But I think citizenship is not at the forefront of how people are thinking about this. And again, sort of, you know, sort of the remnants that are left over from the treaty, from the war itself, biased ideas about, racist ideas about how Mexicans are to participate in this community really begin to emerge and continue to emerge at the end of the 19th century. So I think, you know, this is very much a story that when you're talking about, you could talk about it in the context of sort of the, you know, growing Eastern and Southern European migration that's coming as well to the United States. And this is a piece of that that I think is very much focused on the Western part of the country. Okay, let's skip ahead a little bit. I want to talk about a little bit about the World War I and moving into the Mexican Revolution. Again, I think, you know, when we talk about World War I, this is something where we really tend to focus on the European War and our intervention there. And Mexico is really such an important piece of this story. And I think you can put it into the context of the earlier war, the Spanish-American War in 1898, where the U.S. is beginning to really focus on its concerns in the Western Hemisphere. And its relationship with countries in the Western Hemisphere, particularly in the Caribbean. And I think you can do some really interesting comparisons with the way that the U.S. is treating places like Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines, with the way it begins to really talk about Mexico and its relationship to Mexico, the need to foster democracy, the need to sort of bring stabilization to it in the wake of the revolution. During the latter part of the 19th century, Mexico had had a fairly stable regime. It had been run by a dictator by the name of Porfirio Diaz, who had very close ties with the United States, particularly with U.S. Corporations. By the time the revolution comes in 1910, 80% of Mexico's railroads were owned by U.S. companies. 27% of the land base in Mexico was held by U.S. citizens or U.S. companies, and about 45% of all industries in Mexico were held by U.S. Companies. So you can think about the anti-American, anti-Yankee sentiment that's really pervasive in Mexico at this time. And this was very much based on this close relationship between the Diaz regime and Gilded Age politicians at the end of the 19th century. When the Mexican Revolution comes in 1910, it's very much about issues of income redistribution. It itself has a very anti-cleric, anti-Catholic sentiment component of it as well. And it becomes very much also a very anti-American, anti-Yankee revolution as well. As you can imagine, this leads to
great fear in the United States about the disruption that's happening across the border, the fear that that violence and that revolution, those ideas, will actually spread across the border. And I think that goes a lot to the way that I think U.S. actually felt about the American Southwest, that it itself was not fully incorporated and fully a part of the nation as well, and that these revolutionary ideas could actually bleed into places like Texas, San Antonio, Albuquerque, Los Angeles, that there might be enough as sort of a cohesive group of people there. And so you have a lot of sort of surveillance of Mexican radicals who are crossing the border, and this fear of radicalism, particularly of communists, coming in to the United States. In particular, Woodrow Wilson is very keen to intervene into the revolution after Diaz has been overthrown. Presidents prior to that had sort of had a very much sort of hands-off approach, but Wilson being Wilson very much wants to have things all in control and tidied up and neat. He likes neatness, particularly in the Western Hemisphere, and then that just seems, Mexico just seems so messy and out of control to him. So there are two particular incidents that lead to U.S. Actually crossing the border again and U.S. intervention in Mexico. First is that a German supply ship shows off the coast of Mexico outside of Veracruz, and we'll talk when we get to the Zimmerman Telegraph about the relationship between Germany and Mexico a little bit more. But this fear that the Germans are actually supplying the revolution and will actually sort of use the revolution as a way to make inroads into the United States. And so the U.S. actually blockades the port of Veracruz to keep goods from flowing into Mexico. And then the Mexican government actually, arrests a couple of U.S. officials, much to Wilson's dismay, and it sort of sets off a diplomatic tiff between the two countries that lasts through 1916. On the other side, on the border, there's a couple of border raids that begin to take place. You have Pancho Villa on the left, and you have the Pershing expedition here on the right. Up until the Wilson administration, the federal government, the U.S. federal government, had actually been very supportive of Pancho Villa, and it actually sort of wanted to see him come to power in Mexico. And once Wilson comes into the presidency, he abandons Villa, much to Villa's distress and anger, and supports another candidate, President Carranza. In retaliation for this, Pancho Villa takes somewhere between 500 and 700 of his forces and actually crosses the border into New Mexico and does a raid on an army base in Columbus, New Mexico, engages U.S. troops there, sort of terrorizes the city, in which 24 people are killed. Now, the important moment for this is that because at this moment, this is really an international border. This is when people are really starting to talk about the U.S. crossed the border into Mexico, Pancho Villa's crossed the border into the United States. And believe me, this is a location, New Mexico, southern New Mexico in 1910, as you know from John's book that we read earlier in the semester. This is not a place that the United States really thinks as the heart and core of, you know, of the United States. And yet all of a sudden this border becomes someplace that needs to be protected from these marauding troops across the border. So this idea of how the border is really becoming an important political, ideological place in the minds of U.S. Politicians. In the end, Wilson sends General Pershing across the border, and for about 6 months, he basically traipses across the northern states of Mexico looking for Pancho Villa. He never finds him. But with him is also a very young General Eisenhower, or who will become General Eisenhower, and a very young Patton with him as well. So again, you sort of see people sort of cutting their teeth in these sort of early skirmishes, people that will show up again in World War II. So you have this sort of destabilization of the U.S. Mexican border. But you also are really beginning to see for the first time, this is truly a border. This is a place that will now begin to be policed. It will have crossings on it. There will be only certain places where people can cross at certain times of the day. When they do cross, they will be inspected in some of the most humiliating ways. They're checked for disease. Their bodies are checked in ways that we would find completely uncomfortable and abhorrent. And so bodies of Mexicans now become sort of the site of how this border is beginning to play out. All of this, of course, is happening in this context of immigration, this fear of political radicalism in the 1910s and the 1920s. And I think you can tie this very much into this sort of early Red Scare as well. So this fear that radicals will be crossing the border, communists, anarchists in particular, as well. So I think, again, sort of putting it in this context as well. It's not something that's separate. And as I get sort of this fear of immigrants and migrants as well, this is a moment of great movement in the United States. You have African Americans who are leaving the American South into the North, increased violence, the kind of lynchings. You'll also have the same kind of racial violence that's perpetrated against Mexicans in places like Texas by the Texas Rangers and in California as well. And these are all sort of part and parcel of the same kind of fear that's really fomenting the rise of the second KKK in particular, which is not just only about race, but anti-Catholic, anti-Jewish as well. And so Mexicans sort of come in being targeted by the KKK in places like Colorado, not only on racial grounds, but on religious grounds as well. And there's a much, much anti-Catholic sentiment. The one thing I always like to point out here is the National Origins Act of 1924, which really restricts immigration from Europe, right? This is the moment in which you have the contraction of that immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe. And this is the moment, the people that are excluded from that law are Mexicans and people from the Western Hemisphere. So after 1924, you have this absolute explosion of immigration of people crossing the border to fill those labor needs that are no longer being filled by Eastern and Southern European immigration. So the period up into the Depression is a period of people crossing the border, filling these labor needs because of the industrialization, the peak of the 1920s, overbuilding, overproduction, and this will all come to a crash, literally, in 1929 with the Depression in 1929. As I've said, between 1900 and 1930, Mexicans were really encouraged to migrate and fill these labor demands. The problem is that with the Depression, and particularly with the Dust Bowl of the early 1930s, in which literally thousands of white Americans are being pushed out of the American Midwest from places like Kansas, Oklahoma, Colorado, all these people of Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, those people are now migrating and being pushed into places like California, or that's the place where they head to. That migration comes into direct conflict with these Mexicans who have been immigrating or have been long-term settlers in places like California. And it comes to be termed the Mexican problem, or the idea of Mexicans who are now out of work in California because of the Depression, because of increased labor competition. People who are racialized as they come in to get work relief, either from the state or from the federal government that's pouring in as a result of New Deal programs. So one of the ways that people, particularly local politicians, begin to deal with this is to think of a way of getting rid of the problem by literally deporting or repatriating Mexicans back to Mexico. And here's a photo of people getting ready to board these trains in Los Angeles in the railway station. What I want to make clear is that this is not always repatriation or deportation. This is literally people who had been born in the United States, had citizenship, and you know, we talk about the meaning of citizenship is, but were picked up and just literally sent back across the border, regardless of their citizenship status. But again, through this real economic fear, the fear that they would not be able, that they were causing a certain kind of economic distress. So one of the things I like students to think about is to think about the contradictory impulses in American labor. I think Lori's really going to talk about this. We'll talk about it when we get to the current context. There are moments in American history where we are begging Mexicans to cross the border. We need their labor. We need them to do the kind of work we need them to do. They are depicted as hard workers who are willing to do the kind of work that Americans need. And then there are moments in politics where this anti-immigration sentiment flares up. A contraction in the economy will sort of lead to that kind of change in the way people are thinking about that. I always like to use songs. There's a great song done by Bruce Springsteen, the Woody Guthrie song, Deportee, which is actually sort of about a later period of deportation, but it always works really well at this section as well. The last suggestion I want to make to you is I often have students look or remember when they read Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath and focus on the place of Salinas, California, where Steinbeck was from and where a lot of his sort of ideas about the book sort of came to fruition, and pick up these themes as well. What I really like people to think about, though, is who's not in Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath. It's if people of color have been virtually sort of written out of this story, and yet we know that in Salinas, these white Okies, Arkies, people who had been fleeing the Dust Bowl, were very much interacting with Filipinos, Japanese, Mexican-Americans, Hispanics in these places. They formed unions. They worked together in these lettuce-packing plants. And yet that is sort of a story that's just sort of completely erased from there. So as I said, as you think about adding these things into your lectures, into your U.S. history courses, I think thinking of ways in which you can use these to sort of retell the story and rethink these issues of immigration and citizenship in particular, and I must have passed over it. I finally looked up, I'd always wondered this, when passports became, when you had to have a U.S. passport, it's not till 1941. So that's very, very late. So up until this point, people are crossing the border without sort of any official papers. And I think people aren't really particularly concerned about that. There will be moments like moments during World War I when the State Department begins to worry about sort of people crossing haphazardly. But it's really not until 1941 that you begin to get sort of this national apparatus and ideas about citizenship. And as Lori talks later on, we can talk about sort of the other kinds of surveillance and the ways that we think about how these borders get crossed. Thanks.